Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Pygar Building in beautiful Midtown Chesapeake, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and co-host, Vice Admiral Tony Mercer.
Ahoy!
Tonight's topic, Danger Diabolic. Hey, welcome back, everybody. We got Tony's joins us in the lounge again.
Seems like we were just here.
It does. It seems like it's just minutes ago we were here. God, it's amazing. Take a break, refresh, go out and get some megalodons, and, you know, prepare for the evening. Oh, boy. We release these in the right order.
Yeah, me too.
So that's not going to make a damn bit of sense.
Callback doesn't work in reverse.
No, it doesn't. But hey, tonight, talking about Danger Diabolic.
It's a very special episode.
Yeah.
It's a very special
Phantasmo After Dark. Glad you could join us.
It's not NPR, for Pete's sake.
Next on Phantasmo After Dark. No, but this is what we've talked about for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of our favorite movies, Danger Diabolic, or Diabolic, if you want to pronounce it that way.
Well, yeah, it depends on who you talk to.
Yeah. One of the Italian super criminal, Diabolic, comic book, big successful comic book in Italia.
Italia. Viva Italia.
And yeah, I just found this out recently. It was created by two women. I did not know that.
Indeed.
Yeah. Very even successful to this day. And the movie, what came out, it was the 60s. 60 what? Do you remember?
68, I think it was released. I think it was
in the swinging 60s.
I think it was in pre-production as early as 65 or 60. It took a long time to get this made, but I think it was released in 60.
Yeah, and the comics are still popular today.
We should know this, by the way.
Well, yeah. But this, oh, man, if you like that swinging 60s Art Deco kind of look in movies and stuff, this is the movie for you. It's beautiful to look at, the entire thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, from everything, from just the way the shots are composed, to the sets, to the matte paintings that a lot of them you don't know are matte paintings because they're that good, to the fashion and just the pace of it. It's pretty, moves along at a good clip, and the way it's shot, man, some of these shots you don't think of that what you're seeing until it's kind of pointed out to you in a way, but you see it, how well composed the shot is.
Mm-hmm.
And which could be just a bland, plain, just one shot, but what Bava does with it, you know, with stuff moving into the foreground and around the side. I watched it with a commentary the other night, and they talk about his choice of lenses he used, too, which gave the whole thing a different kind of look.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. I mean, it's a real artsy film without feeling like an artsy film. You know?
So who directed this picture there, Ron?
Was that Mario Bava?
It was, in fact, Mario Bava.
Good thing we got you on a podcast. Tony being a local Mario Bava historian.
I am a historian twice over in the Phantasmo Lounge. Which
that's right.
Certainly did not all happen in the same day.
Well, you know, it's above Superfan, so historian.
Wow. Yeah, so there you go. The Mario Bava double feature of Danger Diabolic and Planet of the Vampires.
Oh, yeah.
That was a pretty early Phantasmo.
That was a few years ago.
Explosion.
Yeah.
I think that was at least in the first year, wasn't it?
First or second, yeah. Yeah, we ought to do Planet of the Vampires, too, sometime on here.
Yes, we should.
Okay, I was expecting that. Good.
But if I remember correctly, so Jim, your former partner in Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, wanted to get a real expert in to say a few words about Bava. And that's
a real expert.
That's a story maybe Jim could tell someday, but that didn't quite work out. So I got recruited. And if I remember correctly, the whole super fan moniker, which has been something of a running gag in Phantasmo circles for a long time, originates from the newspaper write-up about that night.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I believe it was,
so,
yeah.
So I don't think you were thinking about that when you cited Superfan, but those things do go together.
It's true. Wow.
The other thing I will share about that night,
it all comes back,
where you showed those two pictures to a rapt audience, was that, you know, this was one of the first times I ever did anything like that. Now, I've subsequently, you know, introduced movies and done panels and the whole thing.
But yeah.
If that wasn't the first time I ever did something like that, it was among the first times.
Uh-huh.
And boy, I talked too long. Wow, did I talk too long. Just went on and on, which, you know, I'm prone to do in the first place. But when you've got an antsy audience in front of you waiting to see a movie, yeah, maybe not your best option to just go on.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah,
just the facts. Well, live and learn, you know, you pick up things along the way.
And since we've learned our lesson, let's end this digression.
Yeah. All right. Good night, everybody.
Get back to danger. Diabolic.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's so much going on in this movie and so much going for it. And let's jump right in with, first and foremost, the music. I mean, the soundtrack's awesome.
Yeah.
And it really sets the tone and the time, you know, because it really feels like it's a 60s swinging hip.
Right.
Jazzy kind of, and I can't remember the composer's name.
Morricone.
Morricone. Okay, there he is. Yeah. See, glad you were here.
Ennio Morricone, who, you know, he really didn't write all that much music, you know, just for that movie, just the theme and a few cues.
Yeah.
That just get sort reused throughout the picture, but they're so memorable and they work so well.
And they're used at perfect spots.
Am I remembering this right? Did he walk off? Is that why there wasn't more music made?
I don't know.
Did Lucas talk about that in the commentary?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
I could be remembering that wrong. I might be thinking of something else.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember. I just remember that they talked about, you know, him doing the music. And they pretty much said the same thing that we're saying, is that they put it in at the key points that it just worked so well and changed the tone of certain scenes, you know. Like the one at the beginning is very serious. You know, they're getting the money and they're going to load it in all these different cars and they're going to try to, so it won't get stolen, and try to fool, you know, Diabolik. But then the camera is coming around the car and everything's serious. But then it gets to one of the policemen dressed as trying to look like he's a rich millionaire or banker or whatever, and him fumbling with his gloves, and the music gets a little, I can't remember what piece is playing there. Oh, shit. But the music changes to where it's kind of a little more whimsical, like, mm-hmm. at that point, boom, and then the whole feeling of the scene changes right there, you know.
Well, the writing only a couple of pieces and then sort of rearranging them, like, uh-huh. here's the rockin' version and here's the jazzy version and here's the sad version, here's the funny version. Uh-huh. I mean, that's a pretty common technique in Italian pictures of the 60s and 70s especially. That's not unusual, and that's pretty much what happens with Diabolik, but I thought there was some reason why there wasn't at least a little bit more music written for it. But it doesn't matter. The point is, the music is great. There is, or at least at the, this might have changed by now. I don't think it did. I'm pretty sure this is still true, that there was no official soundtrack.
As I know, yeah, there's not.
And there's a sort of a fan-constructed bootleg that you can get out there, which is just every music cue lifted off.
I hope to be getting pretty soon.
I don't know where you would get such a thing. Lifted off of the actual movie soundtrack, so you hear the sound effects and whatnot in the background.
Which makes it more charming.
It's still worth having.
Oh, yeah. But basically the plot of this real quick, if we can do that. Diabolik is a super criminal.
Super thief.
And not super criminal. That's a different guy. And the police, he constantly outsmarts the police. And it opens up in the middle of a story where the police are transferring all this money and somewhere, and they're trying to throw him off the track by sending out five different cars. Well, it's Diabolik. He knows which car it is, and he ends up stealing the money by stealing the entire car, lifting it up on a crane in the middle of it, dropping it in the water, getting on a boat, and laughing as he drives the boat away. Of course, they follow him, and they in a chopper, and he gets in a Porsche, right?
I'm not a car guy.
Little black sports car.
It's a cool black car.
Yeah, and they chase him, and he goes into a tunnel where his girlfriend's waiting in a white car.
Ava.
And don't they send the car out the other end or something?
Yeah.
They send the black car goes out the other end by itself, mm-hmm. and they take off in the white car going the opposite direction, and he's changed out of his Diabolik gear, and they just drive off and go back to the hideout. And the hideout's awesome.
Yeah.
Talk about low-budget, cheap special effects that look fantastic.
Yeah.
Bava was just a master of that stuff, which you would know more about than I would.
Well, Bava started as a cinematographer and special effects man. And opticals were his specialty.
Yeah.
So you talk about the hideout, the secret lair.
Uh-huh.
This is definitely one of my favorite parts of the picture, is when they, you know, descend into the secret lair and you see, you know, Ava walk across that catwalk and down into deeper into the lair, and you're looking at essentially some glass and some mat. You're looking at an entire set that doesn't exist.
Yeah, except the strip that she's walking on.
And it looks great.
The cave. I thought at least the cave parts were like painted foam or something.
If you look, you can tell you're looking, if you're looking at it and trying to process it, you can tell you're looking at mats. But if you're just watching the movie and not...
Nothing stands out.
There are definitely moments where it could just totally fool you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the little things he did, like his safe, parts of it are part of an electric fan.
Yeah.
And things like that, you know, that you wouldn't think about until it's pointed out to you.
Yeah.
And again, the way he uses the camera to shoot, it's almost like he was shooting some scenes for a 3D film. Because the composition of the shot, where there's stuff purposely in the foreground near the camera, and then there's set, matte painting, whatever, set, and then there's diabolic, and then there's stuff, he's coming from way, way behind him. It looks like it was shot for a 3D film, yeah. But it's not.
Well, it's just, it's to create the illusion of depth on a very small and relatively inexpensive set.
Which he does just amazing. Well,
that was his specialty, you know, that and lighting.
Yeah.
And those two things go together, of course. Where his specialty, again, is a cameraman and a special effects artist, but optical effects artist, I should say.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that this was based on an Italian comic book.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And we'll probably get more into that in a bit. But, you know, there are some folks who will hold up Diabolik as one of the, if not the greatest comic book movie ever made.
I've read that, yeah.
And what they mean by that, I think the people that say that, is not... So if you are a Captain America fan and
like
somebody makes a fantastic Captain America movie.
Yeah.
That really does a great job giving us an adventure of the character Captain America,
yeah,
who is a comic book character.
Yeah.
That is not at all what is meant by Diabolik being the best comic book movie.
Yeah.
You know, my thing...
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with this.
My thing about comic book movies is very general, many of which I enjoy quite a bit. Talking about, we say comic movies, we're talking about superhero movies.
Yeah.
That's really what we're talking about here.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But my thing is that purely in terms of visual presentation, visual mm-hmm. communication and storytelling, movies can't do what comics do. And unfortunately, comic book movies rarely do... Let me back that up. Movies can't do what great comic books do. Comic book movies rarely do what great movies do.
Yeah.
So while they can be very entertaining, which they often are, they're in this sort of neither fish nor fowl space for me in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
I think what Bava does with Diabolik is try to think about visual presentation in comic book terms.
Yeah.
Which is not something that is usually done to any effective degree with comic book movies in the modern age, however great they might be.
Yeah.
So when people say it's the greatest comic movie, what they mean is that someone is trying to interpret the visual language of comic books on film.
Yeah.
And I think that's his achievement here.
Yeah. Well, you know, and like I said, some of the things are a little kind of obvious, but a lot of the things are not. And I picked a lot of this up from the commentary where there's more shots than I thought of that are composed as though they were comic book panels.
Oh, yeah.
And
yep.
Purposefully.
Yes.
Even there is even a panel around the action that's going on.
Yep.
And some
panels
of them,
within panels.
Yeah.
And
some
transitions
see,
from shot to shot being like panel transitions.
Yeah. But some you don't see.
Yeah.
But it registers, you know, subconsciously or whatever. But it's brilliant.
Yeah. If you watch it, if you watch it thinking about that, you'll see it.
Yeah. It's brilliantly done. It's amazing. And you're right. That's what makes it like the perfect comic book movie.
Yeah.
And some of the things like you wouldn't even think of. And the one that's almost the most obvious, but it's not because you're caught up in the story and all, is the one where it's shot through the shelving, that staggered shelf in the mobster's apartment or whatever. So it's like there's the big panel of the screen you're looking at, and then there's all these little panels where the shelves are cut away, and each character's head is in a different shelf, kind of. So it's, it's amazing. And there's another shot they were talking about, and again, I saw the movie, consciously didn't say, check that out, but I saw it because I was watching it, you know. And later, after hearing the commentary, it's like, oh, crap, that is awesome. It's a scene where there's three people in the shot, and as far as we know, that's the only three people in this room. And then the phone rings. And then somebody off camera, a hand reaches, and their head comes in to answer the phone. And then you see somebody else. These people were in the room. It's almost like they were standing behind us, you know, and we were in the room up here. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
When we refer to the commentary, of course, we are talking about the one on the DVD released by Paramount, Diabolik, and it's Tim Lucas.
Tim Lucas and John Philip Law.
And John Philip Law, right.
Yeah.
And so John Philip Law is the star of the picture, and Tim Lucas, of course, is the founder of Video Watchdog, and Mario Bava biographer wrote that ginormous Bava biography that I'm very proud to,
yes, indeed, sir,
to say I own. Thank you.
And, you know, and John Philip Law sounds like he would have been a neat guy to talk to.
Oh, yeah.
On that commentary. He's just
absolutely
so glad to have done the movie and have been there and you know, enjoying being on the commentary and everything.
He definitely seems like a cool cat, yeah.
If you get the DVD, watch the movie and then watch it with the commentary after that, because it's well worth it.
Yeah, I mean, for folks who haven't seen this and aren't even tangentially familiar with what we're talking about here, we need to put this in perspective. What we're talking about is a relatively low budget Italian adventure film from the mid late 60s.
Equals awesome.
So, you know, that's something you should keep in mind if you are inspired by this conversation to run out and see the movie. But
and Diabolik has a costume. So,
that's, you know, well, that, well, yeah. Well, so
but, there's that. Know, throw that in there, a little visual for you.
I stand by all the proclamations of brilliance and magnificence, but I'm just saying you kind of have to put these things in perspective for folks who,
yeah,
you know, aren't true believers when it comes to European genre cinema, yeah, of the era and all that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, you're right, it is a low budget action adventure film, but it's low budget done by somebody that knew what the hell they were doing and how to use that budget to do things that a lesser director could not have done.
Yeah.
And would have made, and it would have looked like a low budget piece of crap.
Yeah,
well, in somebody, you know, else's hands.
Bava was a master of cinema.
Yeah,
he was not necessarily a master storyteller, as Scorsese has pointed out. Scorsese's a Bava admirer, but he's quick to point out that it's not necessarily Bava's ability to sort of spin a compelling narrative and take a backseat to that narrative that makes him great, right? It's his ability to communicate, excite, dazzle, and you know, whatever else he needs to create emotionally in the viewer through, you know, pure cinema, just visually.
Yeah.
Camera movements and composition
and cutting
and whatnot. So all of his movies, really, all of the films that he directed that are accessible. Not to go on too far of a tangent, because this could go on forever.
Yeah.
But Bava was involved as a cinematographer, as a cameraman, as an advisor and a consultant, as a special effects man, as an uncredited second director, and sometimes just taking over the whole doggone thing and directing it himself. He was involved in a great many movies, some of which he is credited in and many of which he is not.
Right. Huh. Yeah.
And then amongst the directorial credits that he has, there are certain sort of internationally known entities within that space, typically his gothic horrors, which are his most popular films for fans, that are on a relative scale widely seen. And then there's westerns and sword and sandal movies and various other things that he did, you know, maybe in some cases less successfully, that aren't as well known and are not as accessible for that reason. But sticking just to movies like, you know, Black Sunday and Black Sabbath and Lisa and the Devil and Bay of Blood, you're not watching these for compelling narratives. You're not watching these for the sparkling dialogue.
Yeah,
you know, if those are things that you require, this is not necessarily going to be your cup of tea. But in terms of,
but you know, on the one hand, it kind of saves this.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know. But well, it's not like he ever had great scripts to work with.
Yeah,
and it's not like he ever had tons of money to work with. It's not like he ever had endless time to work with.
Oh yeah, right? But this being a comic book movie, and it's pretty much a comic book script. Pretty much. It's a action adventure. It's the bad guy, or the good bad guy, or bad good guy, the almost Robin Hood character.
Yeah.
And, you know, the police are after him, and then there's the mob boss, the bad guy. It's just, it's a basic action adventure, pretty simple script, comic book script. And it flows along a good pace. It's good, you know, decent story, easy to follow. So he doesn't have to, you're going in not expecting high art or this intense story or anything. Anyway, you're just expecting a nice little action picture, and then what he does to it visually makes it rise above that.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I'm trying to be conscious of.
Oh yeah.
All the hyperbole creating the wrong
no expectations. No, that's good because we are blowing this thing up really big.
But you know what? Forget your expectations. It's awesome. Yeah. Deal with it.
Drops mic. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Bob is cool. Die Boss good. You should watch it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Have fun. Bye.
Swing the soundtrack.
Well, speaking of the comic book script, though, so if I remember correctly, there's three comic book stories that were used to construct this story. And it plays like it to some extent. It's kind of episodic. If you think about
it, a little bit,
there's three distinct episodes within the movie. Now, there is a through plot of the cops are trying to catch Diabolik, and they're putting the heat on the underworld so that the underworld will help them capture him.
Yeah.
That's sort of the through plot. But within that, you have the three distinct episodes, the three capers, basically, that Diabolik goes on.
And that's the beginning, the money.
Right.
And then there's the necklace, the jewels, and then there's the gold.
Right.
Oh, here's something somebody pointed out on the commentary or one of the things I was watching about it. Now, this came out, when did this come out? 68?
68.
When did Diamonds Are Forever come out?
68 or 69, because Live and Let Die is 70.
Okay. There's a few things in this that are reminiscent or show up in Diamonds Are Forever. The smuggling the jewels out in somebody's body and retrieving them later.
Yeah.
The underground hideout with the trapdoor, you know, and then driving down into that. Oh, what else? There was something else they pointed out. Well, the villain's big lair underground and stuff. But it was just kind of neat to go, did they get the idea from this and run with it? You know?
Yeah, you know, it's a shame I don't have my phone over here or I could answer all these questions about dates and
Google it, people, if whatnot. You want to know that, Ben. We're just your guides to a better world.
Yeah. Well, so did...
At least a more fun one, anyway.
Did Lucas talk about the origins of the Diabolik project and why it came to be? Did he talk about whether or not it has any connection to the Batman TV show, for example?
I don't know if they talked about connections to it, but they did make comparisons to
whether
it.
Or not it was influenced by. Because I think that's the obvious.
Yeah.
If you watch in this movie and you're aware that it was made in 68 and you know about Batman 66, I think that's the obvious connection that you'll make is that, oh, this must have been inspired by Batman. I wouldn't call it full on camp to the extent that Batman is, but it's got a sly tongue in cheek sort of
humor. A sly tongue in cheek, not camp.
Yeah.
But a sly tongue-in-cheek kind of nod and wink type of thing. And it's colorful.
Yeah.
And it's fast.
Yeah.
And it takes place in the 60s. And yeah, and maybe it, I don't know, maybe it came about or got more of the go-ahead because of the success of Batman, possibly.
Well, the pre-production on it goes back to, if I remember correctly, 66. So the Dozier Batman and Diabolik would have been in pre-production concurrently. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Okay.
And I seem to remember, I don't know if it's in the book or in the commentary, but I seem to remember Lucas saying something about how no one involved or no one in Italy or however he frames it had seen Batman yet, like it hadn't made it over there.
Oh, yeah. They do say that. Okay. They do mention that, yeah.
So while that is the sort of the obvious idea to have, if you're wondering what the origins of this thing are, it's not, actually.
Yeah, because there's nothing like it.
Yeah,
I mean, only those few elements that I mentioned, but I mean, you could watch them back to back, and you could these were made at the same point in time in history, but it's like night and day. It was like the Hornet and Batman. I mean, you know, they were made at the same time, but the Green Hornet was a serious crime show, just the lead happened to wear a mask and have some gadgets. The Batman was an over the top explosion of color camp fest, both enjoyable and fun. In their own, on their own, you know. And Diabolik is something completely different.
Well, see, I'm going somewhere here.
Oh, go.
Stay
go. Let
me
step
out
of the way.
Now.
Okay.
Stay
I'm going to get in the back seat and ride. Go.
So you're talking about the Bond,
possible
Bond connection.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to quash the idea that this could have been influenced by the Dozier Batman.
Okay.
And these things leave the question.
Uh-huh.
Because as we know, Italian cinema... And this era especially tended to follow trends that were established by Hollywood product a lot of the time. Not always.
Okay.
But a lot of the time. You would have an Italian picture that was successful, usually riffing on a Hollywood genre or a successful Hollywood picture, and then it would spawn 100 similar
thing. Okay. Uh-huh. Right?
So I am leading from the premise that, or the presumption that it had to come from somewhere beyond just the popularity of the comic book.
Right? Yeah. All right. All right.
So where would you imagine that would be?
Make myself another salad here. Are you saying being influenced from something over here?
Would you believe Fantomas by way?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
By way of Bond.
Oh, yeah.
So,
no doubt.
We know.
Explain Fantomas real quick.
We know about Italian Western, so-called spaghetti Western.
Yeah.
And we know about Italian horror. I mean, in cult movie circles, these are known quantities.
Staples. Right? Yeah.
But one of the booms that happened around that same time, that is the products of which are not as well known here, is what people call the Eurospy genre.
Yeah. Right?
Which is essentially just tons of James Bond knockoffs and things inspired by Bond. So we know about a few of those here. We know about Flint, and we know about, which is a Hollywood production, obviously. And which one did Dean Martin do?
Oh, the Matt Helm,
right.
Yeah.
And some other things along those lines. But in Europe, particularly in Italy, they made quite a few of these. And if you recall, in the early Bonds, they used a lot of European talent.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So you've got Daniela Bianchi is the supposedly Russian love interest slash villainess in From Russia With Love. She's Italian, obviously.
Yeah.
And our villain from Diabolik, Adolfo Celli.
Yeah, is Thunderball.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Largo, I think, is the character.
Yeah.
Right.
Largo.
So, you know, the Bond pictures, huge hits all over the world, and they spawn lots and lots of imitators and spoofs and movies in that same vein. So one peculiar thing that happens in the 60s is that producers begin to take pulp adventure heroes and characters that aren't necessarily spy, espionage, swinging 60s characters and turn them into some form of Bond style, super spy or swinging 60s, whatever.
Yeah. Right?
Presumably things they already have the rights to. So one of my favorite examples of this is you're aware of the, I believe it's a British, it is British, British detective character Bulldog Drummond. You've at least heard the name.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. Uh-huh.
So a hard-boiled detective character that I think goes back to the 30s or so.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah. The or 40s, the Raymond Chandler era.
I believe so.
Well, in the 60s, Bulldog Drummond was, here's this word, reimagined as a Bond-style swinging bachelor character. And if I remember correctly, they only did a couple of these, but if I remember correctly, they never really established whether or not he's supposed to be a secret agent or still a detective.
Yeah.
He's just a guy that gets involved in stuff and gets shit straight as a certain friend
of ours.
As
a good friend of the program, I would say.
Anyway, the first one of the Bulldog Drummond as Bond movies is called Deadlier Than the Male. This thing is a lot of fun. There are two female assassins that the title obviously is referring to, played by Elke Sommer.
Oh.
And Sylvia Koskina, or Koshina, I'm not actually sure how to pronounce it, K-O-S-C-H-I-N-A, who is in lots of things. She's in a Bava picture, as a matter of fact. She's in Lisa and the Devil, and she's Iole, Steve Reeves' wife in Hercules.
Right?
And they're a pair of assassins that parachute on the scene or swim out of the ocean on the scene, kill somebody with harpoon guns and all this stuff. Nigel Green is the villain who plays this sort of smarmy, upper crust, snooty gentleman villain, which is great because if you know Nigel Green, you know him as Hercules from Jason and the Argonauts.
That guy.
Or Ingrid Pitt's Minder in Countess Dracula. That guy.
That's the same guy.
Yeah.
Oh, damn, it is.
And Richard Johnson is Bulldog Drummond.
Wow.
Yeah. So really fun movie. Anyhow, this was a thing that was going on over there.
Yeah.
And over in France, they did this same deal where they made the 60s Bond-esque version of Fantomas. Now, Fantomas, who's another one of these pulp fiction characters that I guess goes back to the, what, like the teens or 20s? because there were silent Fantomas pictures.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And Fantomas is not a detective or an agent or a quote unquote good guy. He's another super thief, I believe.
I
right?
think so.
Yeah. That's his deal. So I'm not a Fantomas expert. I'm not going to go too far down that road. I have actually seen the French.
Oh, yeah.
Fantomas from the early 60s. The Bond style, again, Fantomas, because they made several of those pictures before that and then after that.
Yeah.
Didn't like it.
Well,
it relies heavily. It has its moments, for sure. And if you're curious about it and you can find it, see it. But it relies very heavily on sort of wacky humor that, you know, it's the sort of thing and you go, yeah, these guys like Jerry Lewis. Yeah. Of course they do.
Oh, man.
And that's not to hate on Jerry Lewis, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know where you're
The French
from.
Have a weird relationship with genre in my mind, especially in the 60s and early 70s. And I don't know if, you know, they were all high on Godard, and so nobody could do anything straight or
They were high on Jerry Lewis.
Yeah. But they just never managed in that period to do like a straight genre. Of the stuff that I've seen, like a straight genre picture that wasn't spiked with something that kind of spoils the punch for me. And Fantomas is a good example of that. However, Fantomas was a huge success in Europe.
Yeah.
Big money.
Uh-huh.
And relatively. And that's what inspired the producers to make a movie out of Diabolik.
Oh.
That's where that comes from.
Okay.
And so it went into pre-production, like I said, in 66, if I have that right. Maybe a little earlier. And it had a lot of pre-production woes, casting and recasting throughout one script and came up with another. They actually shot, I think, a mostly complete, you call it first draft, if you will,
Wow.
that got shelved with a different cast and different script entirely.
I'd love to see that.
Before Bava was brought into the project.
Yeah, it'd be neat to see, though, wouldn't it, to compare?
Yeah. And Dino De Laurentiis was I don't think he was the original producer. I think he bought his interest in the project at some point, but he was the producer of the version that Bava eventually shot.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting trivia about who was cast as what in these aborted attempts of Diabolik, but I've talked too long as it is, so I'll skip over all that and say that, see, I didn't learn my lesson from the presentation I did at Fantasmo, obviously, but I'll skip over that and say that initially in the Bava version, Ava was not played by Marissa Mell, who plays her in the finished version.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know who played her initially?
No.
Catherine Deneuve.
Wow.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
And there are some really great publicity shots.
Ooh, I'll have to dig those up.
Yeah, I mean, it's all in Tim Lucas's book. If you're sitting there thinking, no, please keep talking and tell me more, that all none of you that are thinking that. Tim Lucas's book is available digitally now, so go get it, read it. It's awesome.
What's it called, by the way?
All the Colors of the Dark.
It's the authority, the book on Bava.
Unquestionably.
Right on. Yeah, so check that out if you want to know more. Visit your local library.
Yeah, you ain't gonna
and
find
knowing
it.
Is half the battle. How many more can I slip in there? Going back, though, a little bit, talking about that they did one with a completely different cast. Let's talk about the cast a little bit.
Right on.
You've got, well, first and foremost, John Philip Law, who was filming Barbarella at the same time, wasn't he?
Yes.
So he was filming, playing the winged guy in that. But here, you know, they say he was saying in the commentary, the way he got the part, he got a call to go in and check it out. So first thing he did, he went out and read a bunch of Diabolik comics so he'd know who the character was. And so he got his own makeup, tried to make himself look like the character a little bit, and combed his eyebrows to point it up and walked in there and tried to make faces looking like Diabolik. And I think it was Bava said, he looks like Diabolik. He's the guy. He's who we want.
He has very talented eyebrows.
Oh, yeah. And that laugh.
Yeah.
The laugh was all his. That wasn't dubbed in, special effect, because on the commentary, well, not the commentary, one of the interview things on there, before he passed away, obviously, but he's sitting there talking, and he does kind of one little furrow with his brow, and you're like, oh, that's him, all right. even older, that's Diabolik, and he does the laugh. It's like, yeah. Perfect for the part. Perfect guy at the time for the part. And he I don't want to say he doesn't camp it up, but he knows how to act like a character in a comic book for the shots. He poses when he needs to, but doesn't overdo it. And just little subtle things like where he turns to look in his body, and it's like it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. When I say he had very, very talented eyebrows, that isn't even meant to be funny. He expresses an awful lot with the raising of an eyebrow or the cocking of an eyebrow. Yeah. Which is important because he's wearing a mask through which you can only see his eyes and brows.
Most of the time,
right?
It's like almost like a ninja mask where it's just that strip across his eyes is all you see. And he has to do everything with that. Yeah. And he does.
And Barbarella is actually a good, if you want to do an A-B comparison to get a sense of the movement and composition and energy of Diabolik and how those things are, how effective those things are and how important those things are, watch Barbarella.
Which drags.
And compare.
Drags and drags. Stylistically, it's got a lot of, I mean, the costumes are
set, some very cool set design, very cool costuming.
But good God, it's like you're being pulled along on a rope.
Yeah.
Very slowly being dragged through the sets because the camera doesn't do anything interesting.
It's the exception that proves that Baba rules.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's so many shots. I mean, that, especially that, you know, there's that one at the end where he's got the silver suit on and he's going to melt down the gold. And she steps up on that step or whatever. And the camera is shooting from like boot level between her legs and he's perfectly framed between her legs and that silver suit a little further back. And it's just, it's a beautiful shot. And there's so many in the movie like that. There's just an amazing shot. I like towards the end when the thing explodes and he's frozen, the gold is on the suit and he's like frozen in the gold. And you can see he's got a clear face mask on, but there's gold half on it. I want that as a statue. How awesome would that be, having the corner, you know? Everything from the costume design to the set design or lack thereof.
Yeah.
They said one of the things on the commentary that somebody, I forget who it was, it might have been John Philip Law, walked in and was talking to Bob and wanted, and said, he said, yeah, you want to see the sets? They're like, sure. And they go over to the corner of the soundstage or whatever and he pulls out these panes of glass. He said, here's the sets. He's like, what? He says in the commentary, Diabolik himself, he says, yeah, none of that you see on the screen was there. We're there and the car is there and there's three steps and that's it.
Yeah.
And it's fooled the shit out of me. Especially the caves. I would have sworn, now knowing it and maybe going back and really looking at it, but I would have sworn at least those were like, you know, that spray foam, those Star Trek foam rocks, you know, they would make for Star Trek. I would have sworn at least that was there. Nope. Beautiful. Hell of an artist. In a lot of different ways, really.
I just want to say one more thing about Barbarella, if I could.
Oh, please do.
The guy that directed that, Vadim.
Yeah.
Look up the list of women that he was either married to or in relationships with throughout his life.
Uh-huh.
What the hell was it with that guy? He must have had like hypnotic powers or something. He was married to Bardot and, you know, and then living with Deneuve and
was he
hooked up with young Jane Fonda during Barbarella.
Did he make a film with each other?
It's ridiculous. Most of them.
Well, that's it. They wanted a job.
Hey, that's not nice.
I could have said something else.
he said that, not me.
But anyway... But yeah, you know, there's another thing too. The way the camera moves in this thing is because it doesn't always move, though. He knows how to set a static shot, and then some scenes the camera is moving.
I mean, if you're going to say something like that about Jane Fonda,
go ahead. I'm
pretty sure Jane Fonda didn't need the money. Never mind. It doesn't matter. You're probably right. What were we talking about?
I don't know. You got any more? You got anything else to get at?
I don't know.
Okay.
I just feel like Bardot would have been a star without Vadim, you know?
Well, she probably was. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the time and see when she was with him. But
she'd at least been famous for a couple of things.
Yeah. I'm sure he took advantage of that, too.
Hey, cut all this out. So you were saying...
So back to Diabolik. But you know how a lot of the scenes... There's static scenes. And like we always talk about in modern movies, it seems like the camera's always moving. If it's not moving, it's shaking like somebody's holding it.
Yeah. Because probably somebody was holding it.
Yeah. You know. But he knows how to set up a like you say, a comic book panel, a static scene. But then he'll move the camera around.
Yeah.
Some within the scene sometimes. But he doesn't do it a lot. And when he does it, sometimes you're not even aware of it until it's like almost stopped moving. Just because it's done beautifully. You know?
And sometimes the moving camera is literally Baba holding the camera, sitting in a little wagon and having the crew pull him around.
Awesome. I mean, it's not done to a jarring effect. It doesn't take you out of the scene or make you nauseous like a lot of when they do it now. It's just, it's beautiful. It's part of the scene and the story. And like I said, that one where he moves the camera at the beginning and it's serious, serious, serious. And then it moves to the bumbling guy and it becomes, okay, now you know you're dealing with idiots now. Mm-hmm. The music and everything. Let's talk about the Diabolik theme song, Deep, Deep Down. Which is used over and over and over and over. And you never get tired of hearing it either.
Yeah.
What do you think they meant by that song?
Well,
it's when he goes deep, deep down into his lair underground, right?
That's right. That's what it means.
Okay, we'll go.
Or
with
if
that.
We go deep, deep down into Diabolik's heart, we'll find. Well, the love affair between Diabolik and Ava.
And they got a bit of chemistry.
That, you know, this passionate love affair between the two of them is one of the primary themes of the film, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, because one of the capers is after he gets the jewels, they kidnap her, and he's like, okay, take the jewels. Give me her back.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Whatever it takes to get her back, basically. And he does. And he gets the jewels back, too, though, because he's Diabolik.
So I think Deep, Deep Down is referring to the passion between Diabolik and Ava and how deep their love really goes. How deep that love. How deep is your love?
Oh, no. Here it comes. Okay, good. We almost got lost in a Bee Gees impression there.
And you know, when he sees Ava in the morning sun.
Oh, we're getting a recitation now.
And feels her touch him in the morning rain. Or falling rain. Falling rain. The falling rain.
A dramatic reading.
Because it's Diabolik you need to show. How deep is your love? You know how deep?
Deep, deep, deep down. Oh, God. No, actually, it's a great song. It's a great soundtrack. Please don't let us put you off of it.
And
don't let's put you off the Bee Gees either. Right.
There's an Italian vocal version and an English vocal version.
Oh, really?
Sung by the same singer, yeah.
Oh.
And also Mike Patton.
Uh-huh.
If you know Mike Patton, who is was, for most of their records, the singer for Faith No More, and also has a project called Mr. Bungle and a project called Fantomas.
Oh.
And a project called Tomahawk. If you know Mike Patton from any of these things, uh-huh, then you know who Mike Patton is. And he did, I think his wife is Italian, and I think they live in Italy at least part of the time. I think that's true. Anyway, he did an album of songs in Italian. I think many or most of which are from this era, and many of which are from movies, and he does Deep, Deep Down.
Wow.
And makes sense of it.
Awesome.
With a full band and the whole thing.
You got to check that out.
Yep, got to check it out.
Man. See if I can find that on the interwebs. Maybe post a link on the Facebook page there. And hey, while I'm mentioning that, you want to drop us a line sometime, let us know how we're doing, or to shut the hell up, or comment on anything we have said, drop us a line on the Facebook page, the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. Just post something right on there. Or the Phantasmo After Dark email. That's phantasmoad@gmail.com. Phantasmode, all one word, @gmail.com.
I bet they still don't do it, do they?
In fact, drop us a line on the Facebook page. Let us know you sent an email.
Y'all want to know why you haven't heard from me in so long?
Why is that?
Because they wouldn't send us any emails.
We got a couple. Didn't so have
if you,
any,
if you,
want to
be rid, if you want to be rid of me, keep on not sending emails.
God.
The lady that sings Deep, Deep Down.
Yes.
I have to tell you this.
Please tell me.
And it's another tangent, but
that's all right.
I got to tell
you. That's what we're here for.
The lady that seems deep, deep down,
uh-huh,
whose name I used to remember, but now I couldn't tell you, which is the theme of the day in the lounge, by the way. Things that I should know, but can't remember. Kenpachiro Satsuma, okay? Stop looking down on me, Godzilla fans. I know who he is.
Refer back to previous Phantasma After Dark episode.
Anyway.
The little asterisk in the corner like they used to in the
comic. Lady that sings Diabolik, whose name I will reveal in my next appearance on Phantasma After Dark.
Just right in the middle of something. It'll blur it right on out. Yeah.
Morricone used her for several theme songs. One of the theme songs for which he used her is a magnificent song that opens the picture, or does it close it? Can't remember. Okay, Connery.
Ah, the Bond.
Yes.
Rip off with Sean Connery's younger brother.
Yes, with Neil, starring Neil
Skip
Connery.
Bond.
Right.
I mean, Skip Connery.
Neil so, Connery. So we're talking earlier about the whole Eurospy Bond spoof, Bond ripoff boom that was going on in Europe in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And one of the best examples of the tongue-in-cheek. Now, some of these are pretty, you know, serious, hard-hitting action-adventure pictures, but one of the more fun, silly ones, it has actually a lot of titles, but I think the proper title is Okay, Connery, because that's what the lady sings in the song, okay? And it's about Neil Connery, brother of Sean, who in the movie is addressed as the brother of him, a very important secret agent, this guy who they never actually name because they can't in the picture. And he is missing in action and they need him and they can't find him. So they go to the next best thing, which is his brother, the hypnotist.
The hypnotist.
Actually, I think he's like a shrink who knows how to hypnotize people. It's been a while since I've seen it, but like his ability to hypnotize people as a therapist translates into his ability to like instantly hypnotize bad guys by pointing fingers at them. Okay, it's amazing. And you know, giving them the eye, of course. And I talk about them recruiting him, and the them we are referring to are Bernard Lee, Lois Maxwell, and Adolfo Celli is the villain again.
Wow.
So our villain from Diabolik and from Thunderball is in it. And it's really fun, and you should see it.
Wow. Yeah, I've been meaning to try to find that and check it out. Him.
I have it.
Well, then we'll have to watch it
sometime.
We just pulled a screen down in a lounge here and throw it on the old projector there. I'm trying to set a out of time frame for the lounge here.
So but, Diabolik is a good movie.
So Diabolik, yeah.
Everyone should
We were talking
see.
About that. There was no, none of that stuff had any merchandising really overseas, I don't think, like that. But Diabolik had the comic books.
Yeah.
But that was about it. There were no action figures until like recently, were there?
Are there any now?
Well, I've seen some custom ones. I don't know if there's official. Oh, no, actually, there's a statue.
Oh, cool.
I want to say. That I saw somebody had this pretty cool, like almost like a, what do they call it, a maquette?
Yeah.
Like an animated maquette.
Yeah.
It looked pretty sweet, though.
Well, Diabolik in the movie is still a cult item.
Yeah.
That has remained a cult item in this era where so many cult items are mainstream.
Yeah.
That ain't really happening with Diabolik, so we're not getting a glut of merchandise.
Yeah. We forgot to mention, though, Terry Thomas.
Of course.
The Terry Thomas.
Who is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
In the picture, I have to say.
There's other bits in it where they try to inject a little humor. Some of the other characters have lines, like the police captain or whatever. And they don't pull it off. Like, Terry Thomas just can read something serious, and he's funny. So
yeah. Well, that's probably, like, that scene where they gas the press conference.
Uh-huh.
I just love the little smirks and the little subtle bits of body language that John Philip Law and Marisa Mill give each other throughout the picture that other than making out constitute the majority of their communication.
Yeah.
So, you know, that scene where all they just kind of got to do is glance at each other for a second and then look back at Terry Thomas.
Uh-huh.
And it says everything you need to hear from them at that moment. You know, I really like that. But anyway, I think where folks might want to draw those Batman comparisons I was talking about earlier are in bits like that, where the gas pellets are labeled.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, you know, as exactly that, you know, that's the kind of thing.
But the reason it's done,
and so the audience knows what they're dealing with, because otherwise it would probably be confusing, because they put laughing gas, you know, they're posing as photographers. They put laughing gas in a camera or something that is meant to look like a camera anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Diabolik starts taking pictures of the press conference, getting closer and closer to the podium.
When the flash bulb goes off, the smoke from the flash is the gas.
Right.
Yeah.
So if they didn't label that, then you might be confused.
It's shorthand for the viewer, basically.
Well, exactly. And it comes from the same place that the gag of the labels in Batman comes from, which is how a comic book would communicate something like that without dialogue. Well, a comic book would probably do it with thought balloons, which you can't have in a movie. So this is what you're going to do.
Exactly. And that's a great scene, though. The laughing thing. That's just Diabolik being a dick.
Yeah.
or just being mischievous. It doesn't achieve anything. It's just showing, like, look, I can do whatever I want, whenever I want to you.
Yeah.
That's it, because he doesn't steal anything.
Well, Diabolik and Ava are just having fun. I mean, that's the whole deal, as they're presented in the movie, anyway, is they are just amusing themselves and one another, and that's kind of, they don't have a nefarious agenda, even though, you know, they are crooks.
Yeah.
What they're doing is just having fun and
because he never kills anybody.
Making out, amusing themselves.
Never hurts anybody.
Yeah.
You know, until the end, when they start shooting at him, he shoots back with a machine gun he picks up, and he blows up those buildings when he destroys the tax offices and all that. just Harry Thomas's line. So if you could just send us what you think you owe. I mean, how absurd is that, you know? But this is so much fun, man. And like you say, it's almost like three different stories. Which it is, but I mean, you know, the central thing connects them running through, that it would have been cool to see if they would have fleshed out each of the stories as a separate episode, you know?
Yeah.
That would have been really cool. It's a shame there's only the one movie, but maybe it's good, too, in a way. Because if they would have done more, maybe Bava wouldn't have had a hand in it, and they would have been crap.
I think it was profitable for what was spent on the production of the picture that was actually made, as opposed to the year's worth of aborted attempts and whatnot. In terms of the budget that Bava was given, I think the movie turned a profit, but was ultimately a box office disappointment. It didn't do as well as they wanted, so that probably has a lot to do with why we didn't see another. As I recall, Tim Lucas says that Bava was actually given a lot more money than he spent to make it. Like he brought it in under budget because he was so used to working with micro budgets, he just couldn't bring himself to spend
awesome
the money he was given.
Man, you hardly ever hear that in film stuff. Now, didn't his son Umberto worked on this too? Didn't he?
Yeah, well, he worked on
a second year director.
For the family business. So probably, I don't remember that precisely.
I think I saw his name in the credits.
Yeah, probably. Because it was the family business. Bava's father was in The Silence. If I remember correctly, he was a sculptor.
Huh.
And also involved in filmmaking. I think also as a cinematographer. I believe that was the case. Going all the way back to, like I said, the teens.
Yeah.
And so it really was the family business for the Bavas. Not four generations of the Bavas, because you have... Lumberto's son is in, I think he's in television because there's not much of an Italian film industry anymore, but still, you know.
So is this out on Blu-ray? Do you know?
No. Sadly, it is not.
So it's just the DVD then?
Yes.
Only really available, but it's a clean, nice print though.
Yeah. The DVD was out from Paramount, who had the U.S. distribution, and it is a very well done DVD, no issues. I would like to see it restored for Blu-ray and look even better, as I'm sure it would if the work were done. But like I said, it's still a cult item here.
Yeah.
And Paramount isn't investing. I think somebody would need to license it from Paramount for that to happen.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think that's probably true. Like a Twilight Time or a Criterion or an Arrow would need to license it. And that might happen. Because
there's a lot of low budget crap coming out being restored.
That's true. You have several of the better known Bava pictures are out on Blu-ray now.
Yeah.
And very nicely done Blu-rays. So, but I think the horror stuff is probably an easier sell for the boutique cult movie labels than something like
definitely,
this.
Oh, definitely.
Especially when you consider what they'd probably have to pay for licensing, because as far as I know a major studio doesn't hold the licensing rights for Whipping the Body, right? So
it's still in print, right? Do you know?
Actually, the DVD is out of print.
Oh, is it?
But the last time I looked, you could still get it, like, Amazon Marketplace.
Well, so check Amazon now if you want to get a copy before they're all gone.
Yeah.
But it's still available on the DVD, the Paramount, right?
Yeah.
Paramount DVD. Mm-hmm. Good copy, probably inexpensive too, I imagine.
It was inexpensive when it came out. I remember getting it for $10.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's going for on the aftermarket now, but the last time I looked, when I heard it was out of print, it hadn't really ballooned into ridiculous prices.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great Saturday night movie. I mean, you know, sit home and check out. And if it's, you know, you like the genre, the pseudo superhero comic book film, this is an unusual one that you'd, something you're not used to seeing if you're not familiar with it. And it's really entertaining and a lot of fun and, kind of a breath of fresh air.
It intersects with, if you're interested in superheroes, if you're interested in swinging 60s Bond style stuff, if you're interested in European cult cinema, if you're already a Bava fan in terms of the horror stuff, but you haven't reached out and tried some of his non-horror material, this might very well be the best one to try.
Both
because it's accessible, unlike a lot of the other material, and it's one of the better one of the more successful non-horror pictures that he directed.
And if you like all of that stuff that you just said, need a fix, get this now. The comic books themselves.
Yeah, now you actually read more of the comic than
I
have.
Well, I read one.
That's more than I have.
Yeah. I can't remember if I've even read it. It might be in Italian. I don't know if it's translated in English or not. I have one.
Oh,
it's like
a
little digest size.
Yeah.
I have one of those, and I don't know how easy they are to get. Wayne and Rizzino's had a couple of them in one time, and I looked at them for over and over and over. Yeah, going in there weeks at a time. Finally, I picked up one, and then he didn't have any more after that. So, but you could probably check with your own local comic shop guy and see if they could get you one.
You know, I've heard.
Or check Amazon or eBay. Yes.
People on the internet scan things in foreign languages and translate them.
That's a way to see
stuff
it
on
too.
The internet.
The interweb.
I would never condone
or take advantage of
such things because it's not legal. And I honestly have no idea if they've done that for Diabolik. If I were curious to know, I would look as soon as we wrapped up this podcast, but I don't want to know. I don't want to know about these criminal behaviors.
No, and he's never going to look or check it out or find out at all. Nope. But you know, you could if you want to chance it or risk it.
That's on you.
That's on you. With that being said, and that disclaimer, okay, now before we go, we forgot to do this last time because we got caught up in all the Godzilla and especially Jaguar excitement and the fact that we hadn't done a podcast together in quite a while. We forgot to do the ongoing segment that we've been doing at the end of every episode now where I prove that the world doesn't need revolve around Planet of the Apes. This is a game that Clayton and I came up with 100 years ago where long before 7 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, we discovered the world revolves around Planet of the Apes. So, you just
6 degrees. Don't try to give yourself an extra degree.
Oh, well, I would never do that to Kevin Bacon.
See how we tried to slip that seventh one in there?
I ain't slipping nothing to Kevin Bacon.
I'm watching you.
All right. Anyway, so the world does revolve around Planet of the Apes. You give me a celebrity or a title or something, and I will connect it back to Planet of the Apes and try to do it the shortest way possible, though the longest route sometimes is a lot of fun.
All right, let's do Marissa Mell.
Marissa Mell. Okay, so that's the girlfriend, right?
Ava, that is correct.
Ava. Not knowing anything else she was in, I'm going with her in Diabolik. Terry Thomas was in Diabolik.
Oh, well, watch out now.
Terry Thomas was in Dr. Fives. Vincent Price from Dr. Fives was in the Batman TV series, and so was Roddy McDowell, Planet of the Apes. Good night.
Oh!
Drops Mike.
Oh, me of little faith.
Ta-dar.
See, I'm over here thinking I'm going to give him Marissa Mell to mess with him, but then I'm going to give him a hint with Marissa Mell to help him out. But you didn't need no hint.
No, I had Terry Thomas on my side. And who wouldn't want that? You know? Right on.
Thanks, Terry.
I think that about does it for
this
Tangent of Plenty episode. So, bottom line, check out the movie and make your own assumptions and judgments on it. It's a fantastic, fun film. So, go watch it and
try one in and make you smile.
Put your weight on it. No, I'm sorry. That's a different genre altogether. So, anyway, watch the film, give it a shot, and we'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Good night.